Well, we got a few more minutes and then we'll get started. The whole idea is when we finish Kaufman's work, he stopped at the Babylonian captivity. And of course, the Babylonian captivity, the pre-exilic Israel, isn't the same as the Israel that we have today, and certainly isn't the same as the Israel that was in place in the first century. So the effort was to try to find material that would help us understand what the transition points were between the exile, the Babylon captivity, and the return of Israel and the restoration, and then ultimately how the whole development of the sages through the rabbis happened and what influence that had on first century Judaism, particularly what transitioned in the first century, where that context of Talmudic Judaism was in play. So, in order for us to understand what was actually happening in the apostolic documents, we have to have some kind of historical background about what was happening in the 400 years before that. And so that's why I thought we would take a look at these three different texts. At least we'll take a look at some of the material from the three different texts. If there's one of these that you find particularly interesting and you want to go read it in full, you can do that because you have the references. I can tell you that Peter Ackroyd's book, Exile and Restoration, has been out of print for a long, long time. So you probably have some difficulty trying to find that. But the other ones are available. Okay, I just want to tell you that I have no idea how long this is going to take. I don't want to rush through the citations, so this might be 2 or 3 weeks or longer, but we want to take our time through this because it's background material that's so important to understanding what was happening in the first century. So we can go as fast or as slow as you want if there are things that you don't understand from the citations, because obviously you don't have the context. Then just let me know, and I will slow down enough for you, for us to be able to discuss, what's going on in the background to that, since you only have the citation and not the book. And we're going to start with Peter Ackroyd's book. It's also the oldest of the three, so some of the material in it is a little bit dated, but we'll catch up with that when we look at the other books as well. All right, let's start with Peter Ackroyd, Exile and Restoration, a Study of Hebrew Thought of the 6th century BC. So you can see that he's going to look at the earliest of this historical development period. That is, what was happening prior to the exile and during the exile, and then how did Israel react to that? So I've tried to pick citations that will help us investigate that kind of issue. And we can start with the first citation on the page, where he says, "The political world of the exile and after must be our concern. The understanding of the development of thought cannot be undertaken without an appreciation of the situation in which it grew. Prophets and historians, poets and legislators do not work in a political vacuum." Okay, so what's he really saying to us? He's saying that if we're going to understand what happens later, that is, if we want to understand what's happening in the first century, because our objective is to see the background that leads to the first century, we have to appreciate that everything that was written prior to that, that is, the prophets and the historians who deal with this issue, the poets, because there'll be some psalms that actually come from the exilic period, and the way that the Deuteronomic code of ethics handles what's happening, all of that comes in a political world. So if we don't understand the politics, we can't understand what the verses are. So basically what he's saying is, if you really want to understand what the biblical text is saying, you have to know something more than what the text in its own context is, and that is, you have to know the political world that the text comes from. Now the reason this citation is important is because normally in Christian circles, we are taught that if you want to interpret the Bible, you use the Bible to interpret the Bible. In other words, the way to understand what the Bible says is to look for other verses in the Bible to help you explain the one that you're interested in. But what Akrod is saying is that that's not sufficient, because what really happens in the biblical text is surrounded by this political, economic, and social environment that the authors were in, and they assume that environment in their writing, but it's not obvious in the text itself. Okay, so let's go to the next citation. So the glossing of Ezekiel's temple descriptions reveals to us that this presentation of the hope for the future remained an inspiration even after events had overtaken it. And eventually, such idealistic patterns were to project themselves into an eschatological event. Okay, so now let's go back and remember what we learned from Kaufman. And that is this, that during the exile, something really amazing happened. The Jewish community was not assimilated, right? This is a really important idea, because in ancient empires, when a conquering empire comes through, generally the population that is defeated is assimilated into the empire. So they start taking on the language, the culture, the religion of the conquering empire. But that didn't happen with Israel, right? For some reason, unique to Israel, certainly there were some people who were assimilated, but in general, the population maintained its vision of what it would be like to have the temple rebuilt. It maintained its eschatological picture of what the future would be like, and the future wasn't a Babylonian future. It wasn't a future of assimilation. It was a future where where God reestablished Israel and ultimately establishes Israel as the primary government on earth. So all of that kind of stuff is in the background, even though these people are now in the captive environment of Babylon. So he goes on with the third citation. It's probable that the deportation affected only a small portion of the population. The removal of the landed citizens, officials, and priests was probably partial. Now, why is that important? Because we often are misled by the idea that the Babylonian captivity, which carried off people, like the book of Daniel suggests, right, carried the whole population away from Israel. And what Akrod is saying, and what most scholars would say, is that no, that's not true. What they carried off, what Babylon carried off, were the important people, the people who made a difference, the influencers, you know, the legislators, the priests, the people of importance in the culture, because they were trying to displace those that would have kept the homeland culture alive. Now, why does that matter to us? Because what it means is that a large population of ordinary people were left behind in Israel, and of course, their ways of living didn't change, right? So they continued to speak Hebrew. They continued to follow the traditions that they grew up with. Those patterns didn't change. When the people returned from captivity, they didn't return to an empty land. They returned to a population that had been practicing the same kind of religious traditions and that was speaking the same language that was there before the captivity. And this is really, really important when it comes to the Christian idea that after the captivity, everyone in Israel spoke Aramaic. Now, it's clear that when the Babylonian captives returned, they brought Aramaic with them, but they brought it back to a culture where Hebrew was still a common, you know, the common language of the land. And that helps us with all kinds of translation issues later on. Okay, so he goes on. However, how much of the devastation had taken place, the Babylonians had by no means carried out a complete devastation of the land. And again, we see that the real historical evidence is that most of the common people were just left there. Right? They didn't do mass exodus. They took the people that mattered, and the other people continued in the way of life that they had always known. So that when the return occurs, the return is to a population that's already inhabiting the land and already living as the older traditions. Okay, and he says, there is little on which any conclusion can be based regarding worship in the exilic situation. The frequently voiced supposition that this is when synagogues emerged is without clear foundation. And why does that matter? Because one of the things that happens in the Babylonian captivity, one of the things that we absolutely know happens, is the adoption of the Babylonian block script, which becomes the standard Hebrew script, and the adoption of Aramaic as one of the languages of Israel. But what we don't know is what happens in the religious patterns, because there just isn't any evidence, right? So what he's saying is, if you thought that Babylon was the source of the synagogue, there's no evidence to show that, which means that the synagogue could have come after the exile or before the exile. We don't know. All we know is that by the time we get into the post-exilic period, there are synagogues. When did they start? We don't have any idea. There's no historical evidence to show us, right? We just know that that pattern of a community center, which was both the civic and religious center of the community, was already in place by the time we get to the post-exilic community. Okay, and he goes on. We may, however, note one other aspect of this problem, that is the lack of evidence. This is the further assumption that, in default of other religious observances, institutions such as that of the Sabbath and rites such as circumcision came into prominence. Not that it is doubted that the Sabbath was of much earlier origin, but it is claimed that with the loss of the holy place and the holy time became more important, right? In other words, what he's saying is, when the temple was destroyed and the people were brought into exile, the claim is that a shift occurred. Then the shift went from temple to synagogue, and from the temple to the Sabbath at the synagogue. And what he's saying is, we don't have any evidence to show that, right? He says, there's no doubt of the importance of the emphasis, both in relation to the observance of Sabbath and to the warning against desecration. Yet we may hesitate to pronounce on this interpretation as having originated in the exilic period, since there is no good reason for supposing that the creation narrative of Genesis 1 was a completely new composition in the 6th century, or that the interpretation of the Sabbath in Exodus 20, that should be 28 to 11, right? In relation to the creation was thought up at that time. So what is he saying? One of the justifications for Shabbat comes from the two passages, one in Genesis and one in Exodus, and the prior academic claim was that the Deuteronomists created the documents during the Babylonian captivity that initiated all of these rituals. And what he's saying is, no, we don't have evidence for that. That the understanding of the Shabbat, the Sabbath, in connection to creation may be much, much older than that. And the importance of Shabbat as a religious ritual might be very much older than the Babylonian captivity. We don't know what happened in the Babylonian captivity. We know only what happened afterwards. We know the history of Israel post-exile, but not during the exile. Now, he goes on. There were not a few members of the community whose reaction to the disaster was to turn to the worship of other deities, and particularly of the old familiar deities of Canaan. All right. Now, this is a really, really important statement, because what he's saying is this. One of the emphases of the prophets in relation to the exile is the explanation of why this would happen. In other words, imagine that you live in Israel and you believe that your God has chosen you among all peoples of the earth to represent his presence in the world. Okay? Now along come the Babylonians. And so you expect that God will rescue you from the oppressing Babylonians, because after all, he is the sovereign God and you are his chosen people. But in fact, it doesn't happen. The Babylonians win. The Babylonians carry off all these people. The Babylonians destroy the holy site, the temple, right? Now you need an explanation. Why did God allow this to happen? We go through the same kinds of thing today, right? Why does God allow this stuff to happen? And the prophets, of course, give us some of the answers. Their answers are the moral corruption of the population and the failure of the people to live up to God's commandments resulted in God punishing them, chastising them by allowing the Babylonians to take over and destroy Israel as a nation, okay? But that's not the only explanation. There are other explanations, and some of those explanations were adopted by some of the Jews who were carried off into Babylon. And one of those explanations is that the Babylonian gods were stronger, that the Babylonian gods were superior, and that in fact, the old familiar deities of Canaan, remember there were worshiping communities in Canaan when Israel came into the land, right? That those deities actually had more power, and obviously because Babylon won, it chose Babylon over Israel and basically asserted their authority over the God of Israel, okay? So what Ackroyd is saying is, some of the members of the community, those who assimilated into Babylon, actually turned to these older deities despite the prophets, because they were looking for an explanation as to why this would happen. And if God isn't strong enough to prevent the Babylonians from destroying us, then the other gods must be more powerful. Right? You can understand how the Jews would have thought of that if you recognize what was happening in the original Exodus, right? The reason that the plagues are there is so God can demonstrate that he is superior and more powerful than any of the Egyptian gods. And of course, to the winner go the spoils. In this particular case, Yod-Heh, the God of Israel, is the winner. And so the people are allowed to leave Egypt, and God has established himself as the superior God over the Egyptian deities. But now we have just the reverse. Now Babylon comes along and they win. And so if we're thinking of the old pattern, we would have to say, oh my gosh, those deities of Babylon seem to be more powerful than our God. Why would we continue to worship our God who failed us when we could now move in the direction of worshiping the Babylonian gods, who obviously were the superior, victorious ones? So he says in the next citation, there are some members of the community for whom the disaster finds its explanation not in the neglect of Yahweh, but of other deities, evidently familiar over a long period of time. The other indications in the earlier Old Testament material of the existence of this cult are thereby confirmed, and so too is the recognition of Israel's synchronistic tendencies. And you remember a few weeks ago, I wrote a Today's Word where I included a drawing of found in Israel of the Canaanite gods. And I pointed out that drawing represents a syncretism between the gods of the Canaanites and Yahweh, so that the ideas were combined, right? This is what Ackroyd is saying here. What he's saying is, as a result of the exile, some members of the Jewish community that went into exile adopted these other gods because they already were familiar with them from the Canaanite experience, and so they had no problem reasserting their loyalty to the Canaanite gods because they were already part of the synchronistic tendencies that were happening in Israel. And you can Remember how much the prophets decry Israel's idolatry over exactly that issue, right? They basically say is one of the reasons for the exile is that Israel was involved in idolatrous worship of these other gods in what they call the high places. And of course, all this does, what Ackroyd points out is, all this does is confirm the fact that in fact Israel was experiencing synchronistic tendencies all during the pre-exilic period. Okay, I see there's some background noise, so if your microphone isn't muted, please make sure you do that. Okay, now he says, the acceptance of the obvious consequences of Babylonian conquest, namely that the Babylonian gods have been victorious, and as we pointed out, to the victors belong the spoils, and if the Babylonian gods are victorious, then why shouldn't I worship them? Now he goes on. The setting up of a great image, whether or not it has a historical basis in the period of Nabonius, represents the kind of dominion which Babylonian religion is likely to have exerted over those whose faith was not large enough to compass disaster as a direct outcome of the will of Yahweh himself. Okay, why is this citation important? Because what it's telling you is that two kinds of Jews end up in the exile. The Jews who absorb old Canaanite practices and assimilate into worship of the Babylonian gods, and the Jews whose faith was large enough to believe that the disaster that came upon them was of God's will. Now that is hard to reconcile. In other words, the last thing I want is to explain my difficult situation, my circumstances, my trauma, as a result of God's own choosing. What I really want to say is someone else is responsible. It can't be my God, because after all, Yahweh is good. So why would these bad things happen to me? But in fact, what we learn from, if nothing else, from the exilic period, what we learn is that the population of the Jews who held on to their historical beliefs in Yahweh had to come to terms with the fact that it must be God's will for them to go through this destructive period. It must be God's will that they were defeated by the Babylonians. It must be God's will that they were taken out of the land, right? Those two ideas seem to be contradictory. How can God choose his people and be good to them and at the same time be the one who's responsible for this horrible event, this chastisement? But the people who survived and returned to Israel after the captivity were the ones whose faith was big enough to encompass the idea that Yahweh himself was responsible for the disaster that they were experiencing. Okay? So you can see his next citation. The idea of a deity judging and bringing disaster upon his own people is a very ancient one. Okay? It might not be a very popular one, but it is a very ancient. It goes all the way back into the Pentateuch, into the five books of Moses, where you can see even in the Genesis account some of this, right? But it had just never been experienced on a national scale by Israel. And so it really was a challenge to their faith. Am I going to hang on to my belief in Yahweh despite what has happened? And if I do that, how can I explain why this is the case? Okay, so Ackroyd goes on to say, this does not mean that the day of Yahweh is thereby understood to be in the past, a single event over and done with. It means that there has been an embodiment in history of an event which is by nature supra-historical. Let's stop right there. What he's saying is the day of Yahweh, you know, the day of Yahweh is the day of judgment, right? So that idea of the day of judgment was already present in the prophets prior to the Babylonian exile. What Ackroyd is pointing out is that as a result of the exile, the day of Yahweh, the day of judgment, was pushed into the historical future so that it couldn't be about the Babylonian captivity as God's final judgment, because there was the belief that Yahweh was going to return Israel to its status of his most chosen and favored people, and therefore the day of judgment must be in the future. It had to be supra-historical. And he says, if the cultic interpretation of psalm material concerned with the day of disaster is correct, which sees it not originally a description of a particular historical moment, but a cultic situation, the defilement of a sanctuary which arises from a variety of causes, whether real or fictitious, then there is a sense in which the repeated experience of the day of Yahweh as a moment of judgment is now historified into the day of disaster. So I can read the day of disaster in 587 as simply a precursor to what will eventually eschatologically occur, right? I can see the connection. And now you understand why the prophets start talking about the true sense of forgiveness, the true sense of repentance won't actually occur until the final judgment, that we're still waiting for this event to occur, which will justify everything that God has done, including the Babylonian captivity of 587 BC. Right?
Are you saying, because there were no prophets after the exile, so are you saying they wrote back into the history?
No, what I'm saying is, you're right, there were no prophets after the exile. The prophets see this day of Yahweh as a day of judgment, but the sages in the Talmudic period recognized that it couldn't be the final day of judgment because Israel had been returned. So it has to be put into the future as another day of judgment that connects one with the other. So we have a sort of preview of what God is going to do when it comes to the final day of judgment. And the prophetic descriptions of that day of judgment are not Babylon itself, but a much bigger event which will restore Israel to its proper position and deal with God's enemies, right? We're still waiting for that event to occur.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to the next citation. Ackroyd says, in differing ways and with differing emphasis, the great prophets and historians of the period see this moment as a decisive one. But they all have in common their acceptance of the disaster as representing a necessary moment in the divine economy, resulting from the human failure which has so marked Israel's history. Okay? So remember, we said we need an explanation as to why this would happen. And what Ackroyd is saying is the Jews who held on to their traditional faith and the prophets who spoke about this event all accepted the fact that the disaster was necessary for God to accomplish his purposes. How it was necessary is still a question, but they no longer viewed the Babylonian captivity as though somehow it was a fluke, a time when the Babylonian gods had superiority over Yahweh. They don't view it that way at all. What they end up viewing is that this disaster, this captivity, this destruction of the temple was an essential part of God's plan for Israel. Right? By the way, you can see almost the same kind of thinking in Paul's letter to the Romans when he says things like, it was essential for Israel not to accept the Messiah so that the Gentiles could be brought in. It's the same kind of idea, that something that looks like it's completely contradictory from our perspective, doesn't make any sense at all, actually is one of the necessary steps in God's plan. Okay, so let's look at the next citation. The recognition that we cannot just excise hopeful words from prophecy, from prophecies of doom, is a recognition that, in fact, doom and hope belong together. As the closing words of the book of Hosea recognize, the effect of the divine word, which is one, is determined by what it meets, whether wisdom or and uprightness or sin and failure. Judgment is the obverse of salvation. Okay, so the reason I think that's important is because we have to recognize that, well, when we read the prophets, we read all kinds of discouraging and condemning material. Okay, but we also read in the prophets this thread of hope that finds its way through their writings. You can think of Isaiah chapter 40 or something like that. And what Ackroyd is pointing out is that those two threads, the one of condemnation and doom and destruction, and the one of hope and restoration, are intertwined into the prophetic material all the way through. So you can't actually remove one from the other. It's almost as though the prophets weave this this terrible event into a story that will ultimately lead to Israel's triumph. Okay? And he wants us to read the prophets in that way. So he says, from Deuteronomy to the end of Joshua, that period of scripture serves to emphasize the confessional basis of Israel's experience. By historical retrospect, we are put in the position of Israel, of Israel of the wilderness, on the threshold of the promised land. The events by which the deliverance has been effected are rehearsed, most probably on the basis of some liturgical usage, such as is indicated in Deuteronomy 31. Okay, why did I pick that citation? Because what he's suggesting, and what I actually believe is the case, is that a good deal of the material in Deuteronomy was written after the exile. Why? Because what it describes is actually the history of Israel between Joshua and the captivity. And if you read some of the later chapters of Deuteronomy and you see how Moses supposedly describes what will happen to the people when they cross the river, you recognize that what's really occurring there is a historical resume of everything that happened to Israel projected back into the mouth of Moses. You remember that I've often suggested that anyone who was standing on the banks of the Jordan and heard Moses say those things would opt out of going across. Because Moses lays out a horrific history for Israel once they cross the Jordan, right? So the only explanation for the people willingly crossing the Jordan in spite of Moses' warnings are that the warnings actually didn't occur before they crossed the Jordan. They're actually a summary of the historical situation that Israel experienced written back into the mouth of Moses to give it a prophetic, a proleptic meaning, when in fact it was just the historical events that occurred once Israel fell into its idolatrous pattern. Okay. And by the way, a lot of scholars treat Deuteronomy that way. Deuteronomy is the late construction of an exilic or post-exilic a rewrite of Moses in Exodus, okay? So he says in the next citation, in all this, it is the law which is the fundamental test of Israel's obedience and at the same time, the vehicle of divine promise. And you can remember the statement of Moses at the end of Deuteronomy, where he says, if you do this and this and this, then these kinds of things will happen to you. You will be blessed. You will have your crops will flourish, et cetera, et cetera. And then he says, if you don't do these things, then these plagues and these curses will be yours, right? So here it's following the law, which is the fundamental to understanding how Israel is supposed to interact with God. And Ackroyd just reminds us that that passage in Deuteronomy sets up the, ultimately sets up the justification for why God allows the captivity. He goes on. Law and history preached touch the hearts of the exilic community, insofar as that community accepts it as a true interpretation of its history, in which the acceptance of the rightness of divine judgment is in itself an anticipation of what may follow. And so here, Ackroyd has summarized what we've been saying, that the believing community had to accept the fact that the destruction that they experienced was actually part of God's plan to redeem them, right? That he was going to restore them through the experience of the Babylonian captivity. And of course, history bears this out, that as a result of the Babylonian captivity, Israel never again fell into idolatry. They never again worshiped any other of the ancient Canaanite gods, right? So something significant happened during that experience of the exile, which reshaped the way that Israel thought of its relationship to God. Now there's a citation in here that just says the Holiness Code, Leviticus 17 to 26. That was just a reminder for me that if I want to look at Leviticus 17, 26, I'm looking at regulations that govern the way that the community should respond. Okay, now he goes on. It is true that legal casuistry has always been a most deadly enemy of religion. And so it was to be again in the case of the post-exilic Jewish community, though not so as to destroy all spontaneity of life and worship. Okay, what has he just said? Well, legal casuistry is the whole idea of adding and adding and adding and adding more and more regulations and laws. In other words, I start off with the good intention of a single law, you shall not steal. And then, of course, I need explanations. Well, what does that actually mean? And what about this situation? What about that situation? And, of course, that's exactly what happened post the exile in the rabbinic community. The development of the Talmud is the development of long explanations, justifications, and rationalizations for all of the additional rules that were added to the Mosaic Code to allow people to understand how they were to respond in every given situation. And what Ackroyd points out is that always happens, that the legal system starts really simple. We have a modern example of that. The legal system of the United States starts very simply with the Constitution, and it now has literally thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of legal interpretation that goes from one case study to the next that has multiplied itself to the point where hardly anybody can understand the whole anymore. Okay? So that's just what happens in legal systems. And of course, it's exactly what happened in the post-exilic Jewish legal system. But then Ackroyd adds this one little caveat. Though not so as to destroy all spontaneity of life and worship. In other words, even though in the Talmudic period, we're going to end up with literally thousands of interpretations of the legal system, we still have it somehow in the Jewish world, we still have spontaneity and a desire to worship. We still have something going on that defies merely rule-keeping behavior, okay? And I think it's important for us to recognize that we shouldn't be surprised at the development of the Talmudic material. That's just a natural flow of legal systems. What we should be surprised at is that the Jewish community still has so much spontaneity in life, okay? So he says, now, Ezekiel's attention is entirely concentrated upon the reality of the disaster. Now, I'm just going to talk about the prophet Ezekiel. He is concerned in this situation to justify the ways of God to man, in which justify is used in its Old Testament sense of chesed, or declaring what's right, showing the rightness of what God has done. Okay, now why do you need to know that? Because you remember that each prophet has a particular point of view on either pre-exilic behavior or the restoration. Ezekiel is the prophet who writes from within the exile, right? Jeremiah, Isaiah are before the exile. Many of the minor prophets are before the exile. But Ezekiel writes within the exile. He's part of the exilic community. Okay? And therefore, it's important to see that Ezekiel is the one who spends the most time justifying exile on the basis of God doing what is right. Okay? In other words, the disaster is from Ezekiel's perspective, the disaster is to be explained on the basis of the necessity that God had to initiate in order to accomplish his purposes. Okay? He goes on, though the belief that Yahweh controls the destinies of all people carries with it the knowledge that he must therefore be accessible everywhere, the actual experience is a test of faith, just as the anticipation of disaster, as to in Ezekiel, can be confidently expressed, but the experience of it is such as to demand a rethinking which only the event can provoke. Okay? So what is Ackroyd saying? It's absolutely true that God is everywhere, but for some reason, perhaps known only to God, he desires to manifest himself in the temple. And therefore, there is a location for God's presence, right? The actual experience of faith is the experience of the temple, right? Not just the knowledge of God's omnipresence, but the fact that God is related to the temple. And in the same way, Ezekiel could say, well, God is sovereign, okay, as an explanation. But in fact, the event of the disaster of the exile is like the event of the temple. It's something that has to be experienced in order to truly understand what God is doing. And so Ezekiel doesn't just say, well, the answer is God's sovereign, right? He does whatever he wants. What he's saying is there's a reason why this disaster had to occur, and that disaster and that reason is that it was part of God's divine economy, some necessary step to bring Israel to a point where God could restore Israel in the way that he wanted. Okay? So he goes on, this paves a way for a future which is dependent not upon man's ability to respond, but upon God's willingness to act. In other words, since God brings about the disaster of the exile, God is the only one who can bring about the restoration of Israel as a result of the disaster. Okay? So it doesn't depend on, Israel somehow earning God's favor again. What Ackroyd is saying is both the exile and the restoration are acts, are divine acts. They come about because God is willing to do it, not because human beings somehow prove themselves worthy. Okay, so he says, the exile is at one and the same time a proper punishment for what Israel has been in the past and an act of discipline by which the future may be assured. Right? And for this, we need to add Zimmarelli, the next citation. With Zimmarelli, we may recognize the real Exodus event lies in the future. Because you see, what's happening is that the prophets and ultimately the sages in modern Judaism doesn't view the exile as something out of the divine plan. The exile is a step in the process toward the future of Israel. And so the real Exodus, the real event where Israel leaves Egypt entirely, and Egypt represents not just the country of Egypt, but the whole idea of the worldliness that's in opposition to God. The real Exodus then lies in the future, where God is now preparing through these steps to bring about an Israel that will manifest his character in a way that the other nations will finally leave Egypt again, leave Egypt for good, and end up recognizing the God of Israel as the one true God. Okay, he goes on. As is characteristic in Old Testament prophecy, the events foretold are not left in the air, but attached to realities of the political situation, though not limited to them. Okay, now why do we need to know this? Because what he's pointing out is that Old Testament prophecies must make sense to the population that heard the original prophecy. In other words, they're not disconnected from the political and social environment that the original audience had. Okay? So if you run across an Old Testament prophecy and the interpreter is telling you, well, this prophecy was fulfilled in 1979, you can be sure that he's wrong. Because the prophecy needs to make sense to the people who heard it first. It doesn't mean that it's limited to only those people, but it does mean that if it doesn't make sense to the people who heard it first, then it doesn't make sense, regardless of how it might be applied later. Okay? Now, why is that sentence so important? Because you can see exactly what is happening with the apostolic writers of the Gospels and with Paul when they use Old Testament prophecy as justification for the events that they are recounting. Okay? In other words, they're not saying, I'll give you an example from Matthew, they're not saying that Jeremiah had in mind the destruction of the babies in Bethlehem, when Matthew says, and this is to fulfill the prophecy of Jeremiah, Rachel crying for her children, right? In other words, the prophecy, Rachel crying for her children, is not about the children in Bethlehem. It's about the exile. And it made sense to the people who heard it first because it was about the exile. But that doesn't mean that Matthew couldn't interpret it about the children in Bethlehem. In other words, its original meaning was for the original audience, but it's flexible enough, given the way that the gospel writers deal with Old Testament, it's flexible enough to be applied to another situation where I can make it fit, okay? So the point is that, as Akrid points out, characteristic of all Old Testament prophecy, events are concrete. They happen in the time of the audience, but they can be applied later. And as we know from the apostolic material, they are applied later, over and over. Right? They're applied to new situations, not because the new situation was the real intended prophecy, but because the prophecy is flexible enough to be attached to other events. Okay? Let's go to the next citation. This is number 27. Since it is God who controls, being the creator of all things, it is God who is to decide by what means his purpose of restoration is to be effected. Okay? So this is an interesting citation because what it suggests is that first, as we saw before, no human interaction actually brings about or affects God's purposes and intention. Okay? It's divinely initiated and divinely fulfilled. That also means, by the way, that human beings cannot anticipate in advance how God will bring about his purposes of restoration, right? Because it's God who decides this. It isn't possible for human beings to anticipate and project how God will do it, right? Now, we should have learned that a long time ago when Yeshua says, in response to when is this day going to occur, no man knows, only the Father. What he's really saying is, because it's a divinely initiated event, no human being will ever know when this is going to happen. And of course, what Aykroyd's citation points out is the nonsense of end times speculation. Because what it's really saying is, what Aykroyd's really saying is, the only person, the only being who controls anything about those purposes is God himself. And no human being can anticipate how God is going to do this. Just like Israel couldn't anticipate that God would allow Babylon to be the means by which he would bring Israel into line. Okay? Now let's go to the next citation. This is Isaiah 41. He's talking about the Hebrew term, Anihu, I am he. And you can see the citation says it's in 41, 43, 48, et cetera, et cetera. A phrase which strongly suggests an attempt at theological explanation of the divine name as being equivalent to the personal pronoun, as that just as in Exodus 3:14 provides us with an interpretation, Yehe, I am. Deutero-Isaiah appears to understand the divine name, Yahweh, as meaning he, that is, the one, or he who is. Now, why did I put that citation in there? Doesn't it seem a little bit technical? And I admit it's a little bit technical. But I think it's important because it points out to me that Aykroyd is really interpreting this phrase from a Greek philosophical perspective. Because I am he, ani hu, isn't connected to I am in the Exodus passage any more than it would be interpreted properly as the one or the one who is. The concept that a divine name is about the existence of God is a Greek idea, not a Hebrew idea, right? The Hebrew idea is always the name in relation to God's interaction with human beings, whereas the Greek idea is the idea of a transcendent God, the one who is, right? The divine being with the capital B. And here I think we get a hint at how much Christian philosophical theology is really buried in Aykroyd's view. It doesn't show up very often, but it's there. Okay? And that's why I put the citation in there to remind me, oh, you got to be a little bit careful about how you're going to interpret this stuff. Doesn't surprise me, though. The book was written many, many years ago. And when replacement theology was at its peak, and of course, Christian theology has always been philosophically Greek. So I wouldn't be surprised to find that. Okay, let's continue. The limit of God's purpose is not reached in the restoration of Israel, but in the extension of his saving power to the ends of the earth. And of course, if you remember our study from Kaufman, you remember that only a few of the prophets even speak like this, that the idea that God's purposes are to bring salvation to the whole earth shows up a few places in Isaiah, but is later developed in the post-exilic period so that it ultimately shows up in the Gospels like John, and finally in the Talmudic material, where the idea is that God will reign supremely over all the peoples of the earth. Okay? We're going to see this idea, by the way, show up in Christina Hayes' book on law when we get to that book. It's really important to recognize how much of the Talmudic development of God's saving purposes for the whole of the earth gets trapped in a discussion of the difference between the Greek idea of law and the Hebrew idea of law. We'll get there. Okay, next one. But the endeavor to put into some sort of chronological order what the chronicler has quite evidently arranged much more according to principles of interpretation brings us immediately up against against major problems to which there is quite clearly no simple solution. Okay, yeah, you can put this one in yellow marker, because what Aykroyd is saying is that the chronology of the Bible is arranged according to principles of interpretation and principles of importance, not according to event history, right? Of course, that, as he points out, causes all kinds of problems for which there is no clear, simple solution, because the way that the chronology is arranged in the Bible doesn't match up with historical documents from outside the Bible. Right? But that's okay. We don't expect it to if we realize that the Bible is not a historical document. It's a document it's a faith document. It's a document that's written according to the principles that were necessary to encourage the community to understand its relationship to God. And so the events are rearranged, like, for example, putting the putting the pre-exilic history of Israel into the mouth of Moses in Deuteronomy. The events are arranged in order to bring about a certain faith reaction from the population, right? Now, here's the big difference. Everyone in the religious community of Israel pre-exilic recognized that that was the problem. They didn't read the Bible in order to understand the historical development of Israel. They read the Bible in order to understand what's my relationship to God, right? It's only the Western idea of history forced on top of the biblical account, which creates all of these issues with what event occurred before what other event and what event came after, right? Once we embrace this idea that the chronological order of the Bible is arranged according to a different kind of scheme, right? Then we will not have the same kinds of issues that we face whenever we run across Christian apologetics, which does mental gymnastics in order to make sure that everything fits into the event chronology of history. Okay? This is really an important observation on Aykroyd's part, because it helps us resolve all of those issues about simple things like were the first people Adam and Eve, and all that kind of stuff. Is the Genesis 1, 2, and 3 a historical record? All that. Okay. Okay. So he goes on. Yes.
I just have a question. Since it is God who controls being the creator of all things, it is he who decides. And you brought up, Matthew 24. And so my thing is, so Yeshua did say, when you see these things happen.
Yes.
He did have pointers. But also in the book of Joel, we hear that it says, God says, call a fast, perhaps I will relent. So
yeah.
Does that mean you have to just not make prediction, but be careful and watch?
I think, I think my interpretation is that of Maimonides, right? After it's over with, you'll know what it was. So in the meantime, you have to be incredibly observant.
Yeah.
Because as we know, God changes his mind. And yes, we don't know how many times God changes his mind, but we know that he has in the past. And so there's no reason to believe that he wouldn't again change his mind and delay and delay and delay in spite of our desire to know what the exact events will be, right? So yeah, my interpretation of that is Yeshua is basically saying, be observant, be prepared and be observant. But don't expect that as a result of your observations and your preparation, that means it's this is it, right?
Yeah.
Because things can change. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to, yes.
Skip, would that also mean just about your ongoing relationship with God? That's probably the most important thing to be observant and participating. Yeah. I mean, it goes without saying, right?
Yes. And okay, the same thing. It's how much a delay has God already granted in our own lives, right? I mean, when we get to Christina Hayes' book on law, we're going to really face this issue head on, because the law demands a kind of justice that most of us can't live with, right? And so we'll see how this works. Okay, let's take a couple of more citations here, where he says, the remnant, the divinely chosen survivors of disaster, the purified community in which the promises of the past are made real. So now, the only reason I put this in here is because we need a kind of view of what the remnant is. And you know, the remnant, the idea of the remnant has been taken over by Christians and reinterpreted again and again and again as a sort of ultimate Christian community. But what Akrod is pointing out is that in this exile and restoration period, the idea of the remnant is already there. But the remnant is the survivors of the disaster, the purified community in which the promises of restoration will become real. So in this regard, we could say that the remnant is the community of Ezra, because Ezra returns and God blesses him with the ability to rebuild the wall, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea of remnant has a political historical context as well. And we just need to keep that in mind. Okay, one more and then we'll stop for today. The prophetic books are full of the contrast which is involved in the actual nature of the people of God. It is at one and the same moment a people called by God, obedient to him, fulfilling his purposes, and also a people which does not respond, shows itself to be disobedient, fails to be the people of God as it ought to be. Okay? Why is that important? Because all the way through the prophets, there's both the positive and the negative. There's God's gracious acceptance, endorsement, and desire for his people. And in fact, in Isaiah 40, Nachmu, Nachmu, you have been, you've paid back twice what you owed for your disobedience. There's all of that. There's all the goodness and graciousness of God. And at the same time, there's the other side. All of the condemnation and the chastisement and the punishment. The two are woven together. It's not possible to understand the prophets by simply picking out the good prophetic material, you know, or by focusing entirely on the disastrous punishment material. They're woven together in one fabric. It's this constant interplay between God's desire for his people and their desire to be obedient to him and their failure. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. All of that context is resident in this exiled community, which ultimately comes out of that. And then we have to see how those ideas affect what happens in the exiled community after they return to Israel. Okay, that's probably enough for today. Unless you have questions and stuff, we'll stop here and we'll start on tomorrow with the next piece. So If there are any questions, now's the time. No? Everybody is stunned.
Yeah.
Skip. Yes.
Yeah, it seems to me the thing that's somehow left out in this whole conversation, you know, we have the people who were left in Israel and we have the people who went to Babylon, but we're somehow forgetting like the, I don't know, 80 to 90% of the population that were slaughtered and killed, and how that impacted the, you know, psyche of both of those people who were left.
Okay, good point. I think your numbers are a little high. I mean, the reason that I say that is, I don't mean that a great number of people in Jerusalem, the fortified city that resisted Babylon, a great number of those people were killed. But the Babylonians, by and large, didn't bother with the mass population spread across the land. The farmers, the little villages, they didn't care. What they went after are the important influencers, the head of the government, the priestly class, the, you know, the teachers, etc. So you're right, there was a huge disaster there with a lot of death and despair, and certainly that affects, and we'll have to talk about that, and we'll see if that doesn't come up as we go through this, right? Well, certainly that affects the psyche of the people who were carried off and the people who were left behind, right? So you got a good point. However, I don't think it was 90% of the population of Israel that was destroyed. It might have been, you know, 70 to 90% of the people in Jerusalem, but by and large, the masses of the population were ignored because, quite frankly, they weren't weaponized. Nobody cared. Nobody cared what happened to them. They just continued with their lives. Like, you know, you live in Bozeman, Montana, and the people attack Washington, D.C. You know, who cares what happens in Bozeman, right, Tom?
But they managed to survive and go on, so they had
they
some.
They did. They managed to survive under the Babylonian oversight. So they paid taxes. You know, they continued with their life. They continued to be fishermen, right? They paid their taxes. They had no military strength at all. So they weren't a threat to Babylon, just like most of the territories that Babylon captured. You know, the Babylonians got rid of the people who mattered or took them captive and left the rest of the population, because the rest of the population still produced the economics necessary to keep the Babylonian military machine alive.
Right? Okay. So they governed the rest of the people in Israel, but not up close. Personally,
yeah. Look, you get the same example in Rome. Okay, when Rome takes over Israel, they have garrisons. They station themselves in the important places. Caesarea Philippi wasn't one of them, but the Caesarea by the Sea was, and Jerusalem was. Okay, but the vast majority of the people that lived out in the land, well, Rome didn't care about them. Why would they? They don't matter. They didn't have any, they weren't any threat to Rome. You could safely live in the Negev and probably never see a centurion. That didn't mean that you could do anything about that. You still had to pay your taxes and you still had to support whatever Rome was doing and et cetera, but you weren't a threat. Okay, anyone else before we stop? I know this is just such fascinating material, you can't wait. No, it's you know, we're transitioning now into this place where we're really going to start digging into what was happening after the exile. And so you need the political social background to see how that works. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. I guess
we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao. Tomorrow.
Bye.
Thanks, Skip.
Okay, bye.